Welcome to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Talk about stuff that's messing with your head and crazy stuff that's happening in the bed. Why? Because many church folks have fallen into darkness. And the Bible calls us to walk as children of light. The Bible says, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, the Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Ladies and gentlemen, are we turning our black men's into women's? Are we turning our black men's into women's? The people that seem to be helping us, are supposed to be helping us, are they really hurting us? Such as the Democratic Party. They give us the impression that they helping us, but are they really hurting us? Now, I guess today on Ghostbusters, he seemed to think so. He's a sheriff. He's a law enforcement officer, Sheriff David Clark. He's a black sheriff. You may have saw him on television and stuff. But he's under the impression, we are turning our black men into girls, sissies, and what have you. And they are working through the Democratic Party in order to do it. So get close to your radio and listen, and I'll just bring it to the world's smartest people. Y'all can decide for yourself. Get close to your radio and listen.
I am Skyping with one of the toughest sheriff on this side of heaven. Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark is back. He served in law enforcement for Milwaukee since 1978 and is known as the People's Sheriff. And Sheriff Clark has a brand new book out, and we're talking about that today. The book is Cop Under Fire, Moving Beyond Hashtags of Race, Crime, and Politics for a Better America. Sheriff Clark, welcome back to the show. Thanks for coming on.
It's my pleasure to be on with you.
Congratulations on your brand new book. It's what's needed in America today. Thank you for it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You know, when I say it's always one of my career objectives. You know, most people only get the benefit of sound bites from me. I'm on TV, a little radio, and you only get a little bit of time, so you get to make 2-3 points in a very compressed time frame. And so what this book, Cop Under Fire, does is it shows that there's substance to my sound bites. I don't just talk off the top of my head, and I'm not just opinionated. And it allows people a deeper dive into how I've arrived at some of these things that I talk about. I'm not afraid to talk about issues that many elected officials across the country would tell me, oh, don't go near that. Yeah. Stay away from issues of race. Stay away from issues of police, minority community relations. Stay away from black underclass behavior and things like that. But you know what? These things need to be addressed.
Yeah.
And after we've had some robust discussion, we need to move beyond that, which is why the subtitle is Beyond the Hashtags of Race, Crime, and Politics for a Better America.
Were you ever afraid to speak the truth, or have you always had the courage to speak it?
No, I've always had the courage. I just haven't had the platform. You know, I've been the sheriff, so a public official, for the last 15 years. And I've been talking like this for the last 15 years, but haven't had those platforms, you know, like your program and others, to be able to articulate those views and those positions on things. So, you know, it's kind of grown, obviously, and it's grown fast. It's kind of been a rocket ride over the last couple of years. spoke at the Republican National Convention, spoke at the NRA convention.
Yeah.
You know, larger audiences like that, where people have gotten a, you know, to hear it and they say, hey, you know, this guy's making a little sense. But that's what scares the left, is my message does make sense. It's starting to resonate among those communities that the left has taken advantage of. And that's why the left fears me right now.
Yeah, I've noticed that people are now criticizing you for using that platform that you built over the last 40 years or so, for using that platform to speak the truth. They don't want the truth to get out because they want to control folks. And they want this division that we have in our country, so they don't want the truth out there.
Sure, and you know, one of the reasons is that a lot of people, you know, they won't peel layers back when they hear things. So the left, or even the right for that matter, because I'll challenge them on some things too. I peel the layers back, I drill down into it, I get to the source of it, I do my own independent research, I do a lot of reading, listen to other people, and then I form my own opinion. And what the left traditionally specifically likes to do is just to propagandize, to brainwash people, feed them talking points. And I think they've done a disservice because they've actually blinded people to what their true objective is, and it's to use them for political power.
I heard that, and I don't know if this is true, but I heard that you are a Democrat even to this day. Is that true?
Well, you know, I eschew labels like that, but I run as a Democrat here in Milwaukee County. I was elected as a Democrat, but I do not belong to the local Democrat Party, and that's one of the reasons why they have a bone to pick with me. But that's probably the lowest on the totem pole. It's because I don't speak from their sheet of music. I don't just regurgitate what they tell me to regurgitate. They want to tell you what to say, how to think, how to say it. I wasn't raised that way. I was raised to think for myself, form my own conclusions, come to my own positions after doing my due diligence, and they don't like independent thought, independent people. So that's the biggest thing they have against me.
You know, I wanted to ask, on your website, sheriffclark.com, you say the person you most admire is your father, David Clark Sr., David A. Clark Sr. Why do you admire him so much?
Well, he was my first role model. He was my first mentor. My dad, I say, was. He's still with me today, 84 years old. But and I talk about that in the book, Cop Under Fire. I talk about how dads matter, especially in this day and age, when you see some of the behavior and lifestyle choices of our young black men, young black males who have no guidance. They don't have negative role models. And there's a void in their life, and that void's going to be filled by somebody to lead, to aspire to, and it's usually some negative force. My dad was always there for me, not only from the time I was born, but all through life. I touch on that in the book, but it goes beyond just what my dad meant to me. Dads are instrumental in the development of their children. They show them love. They show their daughters how they should be treated by men. They show their young boys how to respect authority, how to respect women, those sorts of things. We wouldn't see some of the urban pathologies that we see going on in the American ghetto if we had more engaged dads. Part of the reason that we don't is because of this war on the black family that the Democrats and progressivism declared in the 1960s with the Great Society. Black men were emasculated from their families. Yeah. They were pushed to the side. They were told, you're not needed. Uncle Sam filled the void. Uncle Sam put a roof over people's heads. They put food on the table in terms of food stamps. You know, they paid the rent, the heating, so on and so forth. And so it estranged black men from their children, and obviously you can see what the devastating consequences that has led to.
You know, for the last 27 years, my nonprofit has been rebuilding the family by rebuilding a man. I talk about that spiritual order that God created, and that order is God in Christ, Christ in man over woman, and woman over children. It's a spiritual thing. And when you turn the children, both boys and girls, away from their fathers, you turn them away from their own identity. It leaves a void in your life that no money, friendship, or anything can replace. But once you return back to your father and love your father, then God forgive you, and that void is taken away from you. You can finally have peace and live your life. And a lot of guys and girls, and ladies too, adult women, who have forgiven their fathers for not being there, forgiven their mothers who have turned them away from their father, they now have peace and they can finally live their life. And it's so important to me that we rebuild that family. We get men to return to their proper state of being and get married, and fathers and mothers raise their children, become that example for them.
There's no doubt about that. A cultural change is going to be needed, as you know. We have to begin to, and I talk about this in the book as well, we have to begin to do a self-examination of each other in the Black community. As you know, there's this unwritten rule that we can't self-criticize in public. You know, we got to kind of like do that behind closed doors. We can't be afraid to do that. Really, no other culture is afraid to do that. If you see some negative aspects of culture developing, you shame and you condemn those negative cultural aspects so that you can further advance the culture. But it just seems that there's an emergence, and it's not the entire Black community, you know that, as well as, but that's what the left will claim I'm saying, which I'm not. But what you're seeing is the emergence of a subculture in the Black community, the Black underclass. And you're seeing some of the cultural rot that is emerging within that underclass that is starting to seep out into the Black community as a whole, you know, lifestyle choices, gang involvement, school failure, fathering multiple kids out of wedlock with different women, failure to stay engaged consistently in the workforce, drug and alcohol abuse. You look at those negative aspects, you know, wearing your pants down around your rear end. You know, those are things that the left looks at and they say, well, it's their culture. No, it's not. It's cultural rot. Yeah. It needs to be shamed and condemned. But we don't have, in our community, people in positions of leadership, like John Conyers, congressman from Michigan, who has the Detroit area, like Elijah Cummings, who has the Baltimore area, like Maxine Waters, who has the L.A. area, and Gwen Moore, who has the Milwaukee area. They don't have the moral courage to stand up in the Black community and lead the chorus of shame and condemnation for these negative lifestyle behaviors, this cultural rot that is culturally stunting. Instead, they go along with the left's progressive agenda, which is self-defeating, and they don't feel bad about it because it allows them to stay in power. They've become the gatekeepers, if you will, to keep Blacks herded into the American ghetto.
You know, I write a weekly column for Wernut Daily, and one of my columns, I say that it's taken a white man, a white savior like Donald Trump, to come in and help Black Americans keep them from destroying themselves. And over the last 50 to 60 years, we've had Black people in power of authority, and they haven't done nothing. The NAACP, Maxine Waters, we have Black congressmen and women, Black city councils, Black mayors, Black police chief, and we have Black preachers with mega churches. We have, we even had a first Black president who had the power of the United States behind him, and he would not go into the Black areas, clean out the drugs, clean out the crime, so that the decent Blacks can finally take a breath and start building their lives. And Obama didn't do it. No one has done it because they really don't care about the people. They want them down and out. And as you said, to gain power and wealth, they could care less about the people. I want to ask, before I get to the book, Snoop Dogg created a video of himself shooting President Trump. Did you see that yet? A mock assassination.
I heard about it, but you know, I don't pay attention to Snoop Dogg.
Do you think that would impact other Black young men who are angry and believe this lie that the president hates them because of their color?
But you know, I don't think that is setting in. Look, President Donald Trump was the only candidate throughout the entire presidential cycle that put the light on the violence, the poverty, the deplorable conditions in the Black community. And he said, Black people deserve a better quality of life. They deserve a shot at the American dream just like anybody else. Nobody else said that. And you know what we saw when the votes came in? Fewer people voted for Mrs. Bill Clinton than any Democrat in the last couple of cycles. More Black people voted for Donald Trump than in the last than any other GOP candidate in the last couple of cycles. Now, the numbers aren't high, but guess what? There is an opportunity there. And I think Black people are realizing Democrats haven't done anything for them, and that's what they fear. So, you know, when you have to resort to things like what Snoop's done and what some other people are doing, it shows how desperate they are. You know, Snoop knows better. He really does. But, you know, he leads a better life. He's basically a one percenter. He leads a better lifestyle than most people in the black community. And, you know, he's another one that could be a force for good, but, you know, he gets down in the gutter.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's irrelevant in this thing as far as I'm concerned. And so the less that we talk about him, I think the better.
I absolutely agree. Do you, let me ask, do you have the confidence President Trump will unite the country again?
Yes, I do. I've had several private conversations with him during the campaign. And, you know, he made it very clear in when he on his on election night when he won, he said, "I'm going to be the president of all Americans." He said it in his inauguration, and he said it in his speech before the joint session of Congress, that he was going to be the president of all Americans.
Yeah.
All. And what we, you know, what we've come out of is 8 years of divisive politics by President Barack Obama, former president, divide and conquer. That's how he attained his political power. He's right out of the Saul Alinsky school of how to gain political power. I write about that in the book as well. And I said to anybody who was willing to listen, and I had a few platforms during that campaign, that I thought that the first thing that whoever won, but specifically Donald Trump, now President Trump, should do is deliver a Gettysburg-type address to make this nation come together and start to heal after 8 years of ugliness. The race relations, the gender politics, the identity politics that was played by the left and Barack Obama. And he did it. He did it during his inauguration.
Yeah.
And he did it again during that joint session of Congress, which even people like Van Jones, who is no fan of the right, no fan of Barack, of Donald Trump, Van Jones says that was one of the best political speeches he has ever heard. That's why the left fears Donald Trump, because he resonates. People, he's got this magnetism. All people are drawn to him when he just comes out. And as long as he stays out in public and gets around this blockade put up by the liberal mainstream media and continues to talk to people, people are going to resonate toward him.
Yes.
And he is going to get this job done. He's going to bring this country back together.
I agree. In chapter 4 of your book, guess what? Prison is supposed to be unpleasant. Talk to us about that. What do you mean unpleasant?
Sure. Well, you know, we've lost our way in terms of criminal justice, in terms of how we deal with crime and violence in America. And what we've allowed with our jails and prisons is we've allowed them to become comfortable. All right. We've set up comfort zones where people who are in jails and prisons, they just see it as a minor inconvenience. Now, I'm not talking about going back to any draconian ways, although I think busting rocks all day, you know, isn't the worst thing that could happen. But we've made these things, and I think I mentioned in chapter 4, I think the way I termed it anyways, this is not Applebee's.
Look, right.
I tell this to jail inmates. I got 1,000 inmates in my jail. I say, when you're in jail, you're going to live a life determined by others. You're going to be told what to eat, when to get up, when the lights go off, because you don't get to make those determinations anymore. And I want it to be a deterrent. So one of the things that I've done since I've become sheriff, and I talk about this, I took away the welcome mats and the do drop in and made it clear that these things, these places need to be uncomfortable to get people's attention and to make them say when they leave there, I don't want to come back here again. But when you set them up as comfort zones, people just see it as a minor inconvenience.
I totally agree. You know, another thing that you write about in the book, and I was so glad to see this on chapter 7, where you talk about Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter accused whites of not valuing black lives. In your book, you say Black Lives Matter less to Black Lives Matter than lies and leftist politics. I'm glad you wrote about them, because a lot of black young people believe that Black Lives Matter is a good and needed organization for black people.
No, they're not. You know, sometimes we're our own worst enemy. Again, there's one of those lightning rods that I touched that I talk about.
Yes.
That self-examination in the black community. Look at the crime numbers. Blacks are over-victimized in terms of their representation in the population at large. They tend to be the victims of violence. You know who tends to be the suspects? Overwhelmingly, black people. Yeah. There's an example of we're our own worst enemies. You never hear Black Lives Matter talk about that. All they talk about are the few instances, and they're anomalies, and I'm not trying to justify it, the few instances of police use of force or police behavior that happens in the black community. Fortunately, it's an anomaly, but they just whistle past the graveyard when it comes to the black-on-black crime. 4,000 people were shot in the great city of Chicago in 2016. 4,000. That is a sin before God, and they said nothing about that. And the overwhelming majority of those people that were shot were black, and the perpetrators were black. The same with the homicide rate in Chicago. And it's not just Chicago. You look at Milwaukee. You look at Baltimore. You look at any city that is the American ghetto, and you're going to see the same thing. Black Lives Matter should have been protesting not Donald Trump campaign rallies. They should have been protesting in front of Mayor Rahm Emanuel's office in 2016, demanding a plan of action to reduce the violence.
Yeah.
They should have been protesting at every abortion clinic, Planned Parenthood clinic in America. Planned Parenthood kills more black babies than any other demographic. And I believe the year was 2012. In the city of New York, more black babies were aborted by Planned Parenthood than were born. So when I hear about Black Lives Matter and I hear this group, they're a fraud.
Yes. They can get your book in any major bookstore, Amazon.com or anywhere, right?
Yes, it's doing well. It's a great read. I don't say that because, you know, I was involved in it. But again, you know, I touch those things that most people in positions of leadership are afraid to talk about.
Yeah.
And the object is to inspire others. Everybody to stand up, you know, in this effort to make America great again and to move America forward, to have the courage to not only engage in debate and dialogue on these things, because we may not come to an agreement, but that's why the subtitle says beyond hashtags of race, crime, and policy. We need to get beyond some of this stuff. The tendency is we get stuck on issues of race instead of beyond it.
Sheriff Clark, thank you for coming on, and again, congratulations with the brand new book. I wish you well.
All right. That was Jesse Lewis Peterson, and he was interviewing Clark, Sheriff Clark. All right. That's it for today. Thank you so kindly for joining us. Listen to us all day long because we're in your corner right here on Ghostbusters.